The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way. And that's with Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts and help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's designed by real people for real conversations, and their tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/bluewire. That's 60% off at babbel.com/bluewire, spelled BABBEL.com/bluewire. Rules and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the RotoWire Prospect Podcast. I'm your host, James Anderson, and today we are joined by Zach Beck of the Dynasty Dugout. Zach, thanks for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. I always fall into this trap. I know a lot of people do, of just kind of focusing on roto or just, you know, the formats that we sort of specialize in. And I definitely don't talk enough about points leagues on this podcast. So I thought it'd be great to have you on. You kind of specialize in points league content for the Dynasty Dugout. And I actually play in points leagues, so I have no excuse for not discussing them more. So really excited to kind of get into that with you today. So how many, just right off the bat, how many leagues are you in, and how many of those are points leagues?
I'm in four, three dynasties, one redraft. Two of them are points dynasties. So I would love to play in like 10, 15 leagues, best balls, NFBC. This year, I made a very concerted effort to really focus on the analyst stuff. I think it's like a weird, you know, kind of paradox that focusing so much in the prospect space, especially for dynasty, can sometimes take away from your game. But I have the two points dynasties. They're going into their second and fourth years. And I actually got started with points leagues coming over from fantasy football, which I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about. It's a really, really big growth lever for fantasy baseball.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think we definitely kind of just maybe incorrectly assume that everyone just grew up dying to play fantasy baseball. But, you know, a lot of us just kind of get there through different avenues. And, I played in my first fantasy football league before I played in, I actually played in my first fantasy football league and my first fantasy basketball league before I played my first fantasy baseball league, probably just months apart, really, like freshman year of college versus sophomore year of college. But yeah, I think that's really good to point out. I play in three points leagues. Two of them are on CBS, one's on ESPN. And you might be able to tell just by those host sites that these leagues have been around for a while. 12 to 15 years I've been in these leagues. They're my longest tenured leagues. So, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's that they're leagues I've been in with my college buddies, but they're keeper leagues. They're not dynasty leagues. So, you know, discussing points leagues, dynasty leagues, you know, that's something I don't actually have any actual experience playing in. So I was curious because, like, you know, part of the issues we run into when we're trying to give analysis for points leagues is just there isn't sort of a uniform, this is the scoring, this is how it is, you kind of across the board. So whenever someone asks a question about a points league, you know, I always want as much detail as I can get about the format just to kind of give as good of an answer as I can. But in your experience, or just maybe through kind of interacting with people who have been using your rankings, is there sort of a most common point scoring format roughly? Like, is there sort of a standard type of point scoring format, or is it really kind of all over the place?
That every question I get about ranks is pretty much the first thing I'm going to say back is show me your scoring settings, because they really, really matter. And it's not super uniform. Chris Clegg and I ran a poll in the preseason to see what platform most people were playing on with what scoring settings. And it was Fantrax standard. All of my leagues are on Fantrax. I prefer the UI. I actually think their standard scoring settings aren't so bad. You can run into some bad ones like on Yahoo, for example. But in the points league space, I think there are some generalities that you can walk away with. There were a lot of years where I was, you know, looking to your work. I was looking to Chris and Eric Cross, and I was trying to do this like Rosetta Stone of how do I translate everything from a Roto or categories league into something that's going to be a little bit more fitting for the format that I play. And I think every points league player should think about it that way too. Kind of take the rankings, whether they're geared for Roto or points specifically, and try to think about the ways that, you know, if I'm ranking for Fantrax standard, the way that your league might differ. Some of the most common ways that, you know, points leagues index towards are starting pitchers are going to be pretty valuable, definitely more valuable than they are in Roto. Speed is going to be a little bit discredited. So stolen bases, you know, are probably not as valuable in points formats. Relief pitching, you know, you're never going to see a dynasty startup or a points redraft league start with a closer in the third round. Just not going to happen based on the values there. So saves not being its own category is a big driver. But there are generalities. What I found was most people that I've been interacting with play on Fantrax. If not, you know, standard scoring, I think indexes towards starting pitching. Speed doesn't matter as much. Relievers don't matter as much, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that definitely checks out. From my experience, the reliever aspect, I always kind of forget about that one, but all three points leagues I play in, everyone just starts one reliever. And, you know, we do, it's keeper, it's a keeper league, and it's, you know, snake drafting. And so it's kind of, there's just a point in every draft where there's kind of a, all the good closers go off the board sort of in the middle rounds. But then, you know, you could play, you know, you could wait around and try to get like that year's Alexis Diaz. You could get him with, you know, your last pick maybe. Because if it's a 12 team league or 14 team league and everyone's starting one reliever, obviously once the first 10 to 12 are gone, you can kind of just wait around. And there's another aspect is just we start way fewer hitters in my points leagues than in my Roto leagues. Is that generally true for you? Like in my points leagues, it's usually kind of 9 to 12 hitters are started per week.
Yeah. I wonder if that is more of a points league specific thing, or if it's just a, you know, that's the league that you're in. All of my points leagues are 3 outfielder, 2 utility. I don't know what that comes out to in terms of total batters, like 10. Some of the Roto leagues that I'm in right now have a middle infielder or a corner infield spot, but I don't know that that's necessarily specific to points leagues. That's not something that I've had people say to me, like, hey, my active roster size is much larger, or the number of players I'm starting is much larger. So a 12 or 14 or a 16 team league might play bigger than the, you know, the, what you would think it would. That's interesting though.
Yeah. And it's very, it definitely pops up when people ask questions, especially like when it comes to outfielders. I feel like there's a lot of leagues where you're just starting 3 outfielders and then someone's like, oh, I'm leaving, you know, I'm leaving Seiya Suzuki on my bench every week. And I'm just like, well, that's kind of weird. And then they say, well, I've got, you know, Tatis and I've got Soto and I've got, you know, whoever else. And that's why I'm leaving them on my bench. It's like, okay, well, yeah, you're only starting 3. So there's all kinds of different wrinkles, and it makes it really fun. So you mentioned some of them kind of in terms of, you know, the relievers, starting pitchers being worth more. The starting pitchers being worth more part, are we very sort of confident in that? Because I do sometimes wonder, with it just being, you know, head to head, you can kind of get away with rolling the dice a bit more on the starting pitcher side, because it's not going to count against your Roto scoring for the year. But at the same time, like, you know, if you don't get much that week, you're taking a zero, maybe you're even taking negative points. So is that something you feel pretty strongly about, that in the vast majority of points leagues, starting pitchers are going to be worth more than in a roto league?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say the majority of people that come to me, their question always starts with, I'm going to trade player X for player Y. One of them's a pitcher and pitching is super overvalued. So don't laugh this, you know, kind of proposal off.
Sure.
Points formats, I want to touch on like the Seiya Suzuki thing. Like I'm playing three outfielders and I'm benching a very good player. I think points leagues are interesting because the construction that you have to generate those points isn't as defined as it might need to be for Roto. For example, there could be a week I would be playing Seiya Suzuki over, you know, a better player if I have a particular category that I need to fill. Points, it's just I need to amass as many points as possible. I need to maximize the potential of my roster. And so that would be a situation where I would say, like, maybe let go of Seiya Suzuki for another place. But in terms of starting pitching, I would say most standard points formats, you're going to see the top scoring players in those leagues be starting pitchers. Fantrax is actually a pretty notable exception there. Just looking before we jumped on, Fantrax standard only has one pitcher in the top 10 of total point scoring, four in the top 50 starting pitchers, those being wow. Spencer Strider, Garrett Cole, Zach Gallen, and Kevin Gausman, which if you can pull that apart, it's a lot of volume and it's a lot of strikeouts. Those are kind of the things that I go after in points formats. And Fantrax standard actually does give a fair amount of value to the super elite relievers. Felix Bautista and Alexis Diaz are, you know, in the top 50 in scoring in Fantrax standard too. So again, I think it really comes down to your league's specific settings. It's a very boring piece of advice to give, but anytime you're joining a points league, it's by far, in my opinion, the easiest kind of format to prepare for, because you have so many projections available to you that you can run through your scoring settings and get a sense for what player archetypes are going to play up. What can I maybe avoid or punt on? Is that relievers in this format? Let me double check this. But I think it's really, really league specific. You could play in multiple leagues with the same people year over year over year that all play a little bit differently just with a few offseason rule changes.
Yeah, and I mean, props to you for being there to give advice to people across these different formats. Do you have any, you know, for someone maybe who's been in points leagues for a while, or maybe someone who's considering getting into it for the first time this offseason, or maybe getting back into it, do you have any kind of tips that might be applicable, you know, across most points leagues, just sort of small things maybe that people could be doing differently to kind of improve their game?
Yeah, I think generalities are hard to draw. You know, I think you said up top, points league specialist. I don't know if it's a little bit of a misnomer because there are so many. But the two that I always go back to is preparation, right? So like understand exactly what your strategy should be in that league by position group. Does speed play up or down? Like are stolen bases a viable source of points for your team? Do you need to be, you know, hoarding players that hit for exceptional power, or does a player like Stephen Kwan or Luis Arraez play way up in your format? Where do pitchers and hitters kind of stack up at the end of the year, especially if it's a head-to-head points league? What is going to lead to the best head-to-head record? That is, you know, kind of the big thing. And always run your league scoring settings. Look at previous years. Look at projections. Figure out what is really going to be the kind of hidden source of value there and try and capitalize. I would say use industry ranks as a starting spot, but don't use them as gospel. See a lot of players, you know, that obviously really respect the work of roto analysts, but kind of take those ordinal ranks as gospel without really thinking about how leagues may play differently. The second thing I would say is be willing to be creative with roster construction. You don't have to be as rigid in a points format as you do in Cats or Roto, because you don't need to hit specific statistics. Your goal should be to maximize the points on your active roster, and maybe not necessarily, especially if you're competing, maximize talent throughout your roster. And this is especially true in head-to-head leagues. So, you know, you can win in points leagues with really, really creative and interesting builds that might have, you know, little to no viability in a cats format. So use projections, figure out where the value is, and then don't be afraid to like buck trends and figure out, you know, what is a viable strategy given my league scoring settings.
Yeah, that all sounds good. So my last, and this is kind of a detailed question, but my last sort of points specific question, I kind of wanted to get this for my own information, but just I'm curious how many, because you do dynasty rankings, you do prospect rankings, kind of geared towards points leagues. I'm curious how much my rankings and your rankings differ just in terms of how highly we're ranking starting pitching prospects. So I was just kind of curious, like, how many pitching prospects do you have, like, in your top 10? How many do you have in your top 25, top 50, top 100? This most recent update I did probably had the fewest pitchers I've had in my top 100, maybe ever. And that might be partially due to just how many graduations we've had on the starting pitching side this season. But just kind of curious where you're at sort of in terms of how high you push pitching prospects.
This is an excellent question. I think it is like a, you know, maybe a material difference. I have two in my top 10. It's Paul Skeens and Gavin Williams. I have them back to back at 8 and 9. I think I might be willing to push pitchers a little bit higher than, you know, the typical roto analyst, just because the marginal value on them is so great. Inside my top 25, it's just 3. So I, you know, I'm really pushing the premium arms there. Hi, it's Ricky Tiedemann at 25. Inside my top 50 is 9. I don't know how that stacks up relative to you.
I have 9. I have 9 as well. I'm not counting Emmett Sheehan just because he's graduated. I mean, I do technically have 10, but in terms of guys who are prospect eligible, I have 9 in my top 50.
Okay. I'm still counting Sheehan here. My last update came out late July. Sure. So
so then you maybe some one graduation more.
Still in here.
About the same.
Those being Skeens, Williams, Tiedemann, Mizorowski, Brian Wu, Cade Horton, AJ Smith-Shawver, Emmett Sheehan, and Andrew Painter. And then I have 23 in my top 100.
So yeah, that's probably the biggest difference, I guess, is just I have 16 in my top 100, 17 if you count Sheehan. So you've got 6 more in your top 100. So I mean, it's there's a little bit more there, but that also could even just come down to the way you and I are valuing certain pitchers sort of in that 15 to 30 range among pitching prospects. I've just got a bunch of them sort of clogged up in the like 115 to 165 range or so, but there's definitely a case for several of those guys to be higher than that. So
yeah, I think about it, I'm probably more willing to push some of those fringy top 100 guys into the top 100, just given the pressure on arms, at least, you know, based on what I'm hearing from most people I interact with. You know, the drop off to, like, you know, the expected outcome for some of those guys beyond the top 50 drops off to, you know, average regular pretty quickly. And so I might be willing to take a stab on some really high upside, even younger arms that don't have a ton of proximity. I think that might be the biggest difference there.
Sure, sure. So yeah, I mean, you're definitely chasing upside on the pitching side of things. Has this been kind of a weird year for you, just from in your points leagues, just in terms of how many pitchers have kind of emerged from and just kind of beat expectations from starting pitchers from before the season through the first 3 or 4 months of the season? I feel like there've been more, like, if you've been kind of paying attention to the wire and stuff, there's been more useful starting pitchers popping up, it seems like, than ever before. Has that kind of shifted any sort of balance of power in any of your points leagues, just with these guys emerging, or with them being dynasty leagues where these guys all pretty much rostered in the first place?
Yeah, dynasties, a lot of them were rostered. I will say the one that came immediately to mind was JP France, who was not somebody that I had, you know, prognosticated as a big part of any dynasty team. I think that is maybe also an argument for not pushing arms too high when we're seeing a lot of success. We're also seeing this trend of arms jumping over the PCL or skipping AAA entirely. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's a good point about points leagues is you can afford to take a shot on arms as they get a crack at the MLB roster. And if they perform well, and maybe you're not totally bought in, that's a place where you can flip for excess value because, you know, in my experience, everybody's kind of hurting for pitching, especially when you get into deeper points leagues, you know, 20 teams and above. I will say my ranks feel a little bit barren after all of these arms coming up and staying up. I don't know if that is a totally outlandish trend. I think it's more success than I thought we would see at the beginning of the year with a lot of these players. I'm also noticing that I feel like I have fewer big time pop-up pitchers this year, and maybe that's because they're all graduating so soon, but curious what your take is on that.
Huh? Yeah. I do think the prospect rankings, when we get to the end of the season and when we, you know, especially kind of get into like December, January, I think people are going to be a lot more comfortable with some of the pitching prospects who have really kind of come on strong over the past, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and then, you know, now through the end of the season. I don't necessarily know exactly which guys it'll be, but, you know, I think, you know, the Red Sox have a few guys who are really shooting up, and, you know, you got guys like, you know, Caden Dana, Jackson Ferris, Owen Murphy, guys from last year's draft class who have kind of been popping this summer. I think there are a lot of guys that have kind of gone from sort of ranked in the sort of post 250 range that are now kind of clear top 200, pushing top 150. And by the time we get to November, December, I do think there will be, you know, 25, 30 pitching prospects that most people feel really comfortable with as sort of universal top 150 prospects. But I just think a lot of them, you know, kind of looking at my rankings, you know, guys like Mason Black, Jairo Iriarte, Blade Tidwell, guys like that. It's really sort of been the past 2 months or so that's really kind of pushing a lot of their value. So I don't think, you know, there's enough trust kind of in the industry in those guys sort of being what they've shown recently. But I do think when we get to the offseason, I think there'll be, you know, kind of a crop of pitching prospects that people feel pretty comfortable with.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'm thinking about, this is about the time last year where things really hit go for Andrew Painter, for example. Mm-hmm. So it might just be, you know, we're at a point in the year where we don't have the sample to really throw guys way up rankings.
Right. Right. I think that's exactly where we're at right now. Is it's just very, there isn't much consensus in terms of which pitching prospects make up sort of the back half of like a top 30 pitching prospects. I just think it's very much get your guy, value the guys you like the most right now. But I do think there will be kind of more of a consensus in the off season. And you and I, we'll talk about this at the end, but you and I are both in this midseason prospect mock that Eric and Chris put on for the Toolshed podcast. And yeah, I'm just looking at the pitching prospects that have gone there. And I mean, it is kind of all over the place. You know, maybe round four, round five, they start going, but yeah, it's been pitching prospects. I feel like it's always this way. It's just kind of beauty in the eye of the beholder, but it is an interesting time. Like you could, in some shallower leagues, you could add a guy right now, maybe even who's I might consider like a borderline top 30 pitching prospect. So a very interesting time. Okay. Let's head to a message from our sponsors. When we come back, Zach and I are going to recap the best prospects to move at the deadline.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
We know the weather can impact how far a ball can fly, but we never know what all the heat and humidity or cold air is really doing to the ball. The Home Run Forecast Index gives us an easy way to determine how good or bad the air is for ball flight. The index is calculated by measuring stadium-specific weather conditions and is displayed on a scale from 1 to 10, 1 being the most unfavorable for a good ball flight and 10 indicating the most favorable air. There is a strong correlation between the index and the number of runs scored per game and the number of home runs hit. Games that have the highest index, 10 for the whole game, average over 10 runs and 2.8 homers over the course of a year. An index is created for each game so you can see what it will be for any stadium and how the weather's influence might change over the course of the game, as well as the wind direction. Right now, you can get access to the HRF premium site for only $5 a month and see what the index will look like for every hour of every game. Go to homerunforecast.com now to sign up. Okay, Zach, we're back. And, you know, I don't really want to spend too much time on the big league side of what happened at the trade deadline. You know, plenty of people have recapped that already. But I did want to touch on the prospects. Because, you know, that's what you and I kind of specialize in. And I wanted to start with the Mets. You know, the Mets bring in Luis Angel Acuña, Drew Gilbert, Ryan Clifford, Marco Vargas, kind of most notably there. And, you know, I think Acuña is a great place to start here, especially while we're kind of discussing the differences of Roto and points, because at least sort of, you know, from my perspective, I think Acuña is very much a Roto prospect. Like, I think he's a guy where the valuation, how much I would care about having him, would definitely change if I was in a roto league versus a points league, because I do think he's, to me, his upside is sort of like a premium version of Tommy Edman. And that's a great player, and that's a useful player in points leagues, but I think it's more useful probably in roto leagues. Is that a good read on that?
That, I think that's an excellent read on that. A lot of his value is going to come from the speed that he provides. He's got a neon green light when he's on first base and loves to run. That's not going to play as well in points leagues, but if I were ranking for roto, I'd certainly have him inside my top 50.
Yeah. And I thought that was a pretty good get for the Mets, and he brings defensive value to the table as well. So a good real life prospect in addition to a good fantasy prospect. What about Drew Gilbert, Ryan Clifford, Marco Vargas? Do you have a favorite among that trio? I think Clifford to me strikes me as definitely a very good points league prospect.
Yes. Just going by my ranks, my, I guess, air quotes favorite would be Drew Gilbert. He is inside my top 50. I think he's around 47 or so. It's a profile that plays really well in points, as does Clifford. Gilbert, closer to the majors, makes a ton of contact, is going to be the top of the order spark plug. I loved watching him in college. He's kind of similar in stature and even profile a little bit, to guys like Joey Ortiz and Sal Frelick. He's a little bit smaller than a guy like Jackson Merrill, but I'm thinking that, bat first, the contact profile over impact for now is kind of how he is going to make his, how he's going to score points for you. It's above average contact. It's a little bit of a smaller frame. When he does get the power, it's pull side. He's air quotes safer prospect in my mind. Where I'm at with Clifford, I really like his profile for points formats. He just missed my top 100. I think I have him at 109. The difference between 109 and 99 is pretty negligible. Mm-hmm. But he's demolishing High A with, albeit Asheville, in his age 19 season. My only hesitation is pushing up too far what I think is probably a first base only profile. He spent some time in the outfield, too high, too quick. I kind of have the same thing with a Xavier Isaac type. But I like them both a lot. I think it's really interesting that Steve Cohen is buying prospects this time around. They got, a lot of good gets there. Their farm is significantly better than it was a week ago.
Yep.
And with Scherzer's comments on the way out, talking about how they're not going to compete for a year or two, I'm really interested to see where Cohen and Epler take this. And I think they did well here.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's a secret that David Stearns is probably going to take over next year. And he very much likes to operate with a kind of controlled payroll and get as many good prospects in the system as possible and try to get something that's sort of a set it and forget it in terms of the talent on the 40 man. But interesting to note with Gilbert and Clifford that they're both left-handed hitters. So they weren't necessarily going to be able to take advantage of the Crawford boxes the way that, right-handed hitting Astros prospect might. But I do really like Gilbert. He's been really kind of all contact, not a ton of patience over this sort of hot stretch he's been on over the past month as he kind of gets dialed into double-A pitching. And then, I think just based on the reactions I've seen on Twitter, I think Clifford and Marco Vargas might be a little overrated. Just in some circles, I think, whenever a prospect gets traded, who's not necessarily a household name, but is someone where, a lot of prospect analysts are sort of hip to their value or what they're all about, there kind of becomes sort of a race among analysts to sort of be like, I love Marco Vargas. I've been on Marco Vargas for months or, you know, Clifford is my number 20 overall prospect or whatever. And it's kind of, it's more sort of that they're in the news and they were traded than something actually happened that affected their value. So I don't know. Do you have a read on where Vargas should be ranked? Like, I just, you know, I know he's got an amazing hit tool. He's great at making contact and stuff, but he is still a ways away. And I don't know how much category juice there is there long-term. There's kind of a lot riding on that hit tool.
Yeah. I do think the reactions to that trade was really funny. It was a lot of people being like, who is Marco Vargas? And then a lot of analysts saying, you know, he would be in our top 100 at the midseason update or whatever the case was. I am admittedly less familiar with Vargas. Some of the DSL and complex league guys, I haven't gotten a ton of eyes on. From what I've read, you know, he just turned 18. He's playing very well at the complex. I think he's OPSing like 900. You already mentioned the hit tool. There's some pretty interesting zone contact data for him floating out there. I've seen conflicting sources on what his zone contact looks like. Some of it says it's you know, elite. Some of it says it's just very good. You know, the diminishing returns on contact are such that maybe I don't mind as much. I've also seen some comps of his TrackMan data in the Florida complex and heard favorable comparisons to like Max Clark's circuit TrackMan data. Some of the guys at Baseball America were referencing that. I think you're right, though. This would probably be a good time to try to capitalize on value or that buzz from the deadline, because there is kind of that everybody always wants to be the guy that is way in on the buzzy prospect.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think we got to come back to just the fact the Mets did a great job here restocking the farm. I would hope that they try to go for it again next year, but I mean, I guess we'll see on that front. What did you make of, you know, this is my favorite type of trade. I love just a one for one, you know, maybe a challenge trade, but I love when two really good baseball players get traded for one another. Aaron Civale for Kyle Manzardo. I know that didn't happen yesterday, but what was your sort of takeaway or reaction, I guess, to the Civale for Manzardo switch between the Guardians and the Rays?
I was really surprised at first. And then I try to live by the mantra that I should never think I'm smarter than the Tampa Bay Rays. I do really like Kyle Manzardo. I think he's a premium first base prospect. He's running an 80% overall contact rate, 88% zone contact rate. His 90th percentile exit velo has ticked up. I know the surface numbers don't look super good this year. He's running a career low BABIP, which I think is really suppressing some things. And he has some unfortunate off the field stuff going on that we don't have to get too into, but would be weighing heavily, I can imagine. So I'm still very into Manzardo. I read this more as the Rays feel like they have their first base options kind of figured out. Yandy Diaz performance this year has been stellar. They still have Aranda. Meade can play some first base. They're kind of overflowing with these guys that project at a corner. And Yandy's under contract through 2026. So my initial reaction was, you know, what do the Rays know about Manzardo? After sleeping on it, Civale feels like an arm the Rays might target. I think Eno was quoting he's number one in curveball stuff plus this year. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do with him. Helps them probably more right now than Manzardo was going to anyway. I'm still very in on Manzardo. I'm trying not to take the Rays trading him away as a harbinger for bad things to come.
Yeah, no, I think that's very smart. I don't think anyone who has Manzardo in a dynasty league should feel any lower on him than before. And honestly, I would like it if I had him in a dynasty league, just because I think it's a very, very clear path to everyday playing time with the Guardians for him. Whereas I think eventually it would have sorted itself out and he would have been playing pretty much every day with the Rays. But as you said, there was just never going to be sort of a rush to sort of hand him the keys. There might have been sort of an up and down thing with him. They might have given him, you know, 3 weeks and sent him back to AAA if he wasn't crushing it, just because they do have all these options. They do have Curtis Meade already on the 40 man. They've got Xavier Isaac kind of, you know, breaking out in the lower levels. So they dealt from a position of strength. And I think people might really sort of underestimate Aaron Civale's value to big league baseball teams. It's just so hard to find controllable mid rotation starting pitching. And you know, I think the Rays, Cleveland probably made him available, and you know, I'm sure a lot of teams wanted to get their hands on him, and the Rays put that big chip on the table and got it done. So I really wouldn't look at this as any sort of a reason to downgrade Manzardo. I think you nailed a lot of that stuff with just stuff going on in his life and probably a little bit unlucky this year. So, and he's such a Guardians prospect, really. I mean, they love guys that make contact at a high clip. They love guys that put the ball in play, and Manzardo will definitely do that. So I think it was just a really good trade that's going to help both clubs. And obviously the Rays are going for it this year, and I don't think Manzardo was going to help them in 2023.
Right. I totally agree. One last note there is this trade, I think, was really emblematic of the difference between real life baseball values and fantasy baseball values. I think we forget a little bit about how important defense is, and you know, being at the top of the defensive spectrum, it's really important to big league teams. So that certainly plays a part too. And then I like your note about, you know, controllable mid rotation pitching is a premium asset.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Zach Eflin, like if you just kind of look at what the Rays did with Zach Eflin this year, I mean, I think Aaron Civale might even be more highly thought of right now than Zach Eflin was when they signed him over the offseason. So, okay. Now this next trade, I absolutely love for one side. And I'm kind of lower on for the other side, but Jake Berger for Jake Eater. I really love this for the Marlins. I mean, they might not do anything this year, but I just love that they added this type of power bat to the lineup. And Jake Eater has a lot of fans in the prospect analyst community. I think a lot of that still sort of stems from what he did pre-Tommy John. And I kind of think the White Sox sort of painted themselves into a corner here with basically just having an excess of designated hitters and a major shortage of viable big league starters. But what's your read on it? I mean, I'd be interested for kind of an outside opinion, because I'm very, very high on Jake Berger's power. You know, he's got some other issues, but what did you think of that one? Berger for Eater.
I love a Jake for Jake challenge trade. I also, you know, was seeing some funny takes about the Marlins going from an all second baseman defense to an all first base defense after also acquiring Josh Bell. Yeah, I mean, interesting. The Marlins really needed some thump in that lineup. Berger is coming off of an extremely cold June. July was better. You know, so I'm hoping he can be what they want him to be. I don't want to throw cold water on Eater either. But Tommy John is not a riskless surgery. His stuff doesn't look, at least visually to me, quite the way that it did pre Tommy John. His fastball right now is sitting in the low 90s. Not a lot of, ride or run on it at all. And the sweeper, the velo separation is, you know, between the sweeper and the fastball is, there's a lot there. I don't think it's going to miss a ton of bats. I'm definitely down on him from where I was pre Tommy John. I'm trying not to let the helium of how good he looked, pre-injury, carry me there. And I think he's a little less interesting in Chicago's organization as well. If I can keep an interesting developing arm in Miami for fantasy purposes, that's probably where I want to go. I like this for Miami. I think it's a really it fills a need at the big league level for an arm that we're not totally sure who he's going to be coming off of a, you know, what is a major injury.
Yeah, and I would just caution people, like I know people love to reference like the great work that Eric Longenhagen does at Fangraphs on prospects, but every time I go to Jake Eater's page, I see that TLDR nearly back from TJ Eater might be lefty Spencer Strider. People need to realize that was before Spencer Strider was Spencer Strider, was when that TLDR was posted. So you just got to be careful, like relying on that type of thing for analyzing these guys. And Eater is the epitome of a spare part for the Marlins. You know, they have, like, pitching is what they know how to do. That's what they can develop. That's what they can target. And they know that that's kind of their wheelhouse. And you have a guy coming back from injury, stuff is down. They could part with Jake Eater and not lose a ton of sleep, I would imagine. So, an interesting trade, you know, one of the more interesting trades, I think, of the deadline there. We don't have to go into each specific deal, but, you know, the Cardinals really reloaded their farm system. I mean, I think it's probably almost a blessing for them that they were this far out of the hunt and couldn't kind of talk themselves into being buyers. So they bring in Thomas Sejesi, Cesar Prieto, Zach Showalter, Tekoa Roby, Adam Klofenstein, Drew Rahm, among others. Do you have any favorites of the prospects that St. Louis acquired at this year's deadline? Any kind of overall thoughts about the types of players they went after?
A bunch of these guys feel like Cardinals to me. The three that come to mind immediately are Cesar Prieto, Thomas Ajayi, and Zach Showalter was actually my favorite of the bunch. Nice. He's only got 30 innings in his professional career, but the stuff looks really good. Fastball is mid-90s, very flat approach angle. His, you know, release height, at least visually, is very low. That fastball plays way up. The sweeper and changeup are really good. It's a small track record, but visually it's really impressive stuff, and the results have been superb. So he's one, as a Brewers fan, that makes me a little bit nervous, for him to be in the Cardinal system. Prieto, you know, I think he just feels like a really solid big leaguer. Baltimore could really afford to let him go. There were a lot of pieces in the way for him to get any kind of significant big league run.
Yep.
He's just never going to strike out. I think he's striking out like 8% of the time in AAA right now. It's a profile that should play well in points. I just don't really see him being a difference maker, but he's going to be he profiles like a solid big league regular, which is, you know, the Cardinals kind of stockpile those guys. And then Sejesi, you know, rounding out my top three that I think they got back. I wrote him up as a deep league target preseason. I really liked the, you know, idea that he could break out this year and actually be more of a chip to trade for fantasy than for real life baseball. I got part of it right. He got off to a really slow start this year, had a really bad April, but his May, June, and July have been scorching. I think he probably profiles best as a second baseman. Not a ton of, as you would say, category juice there, I think. But it's a lot more interesting at second base for fantasy purposes. I think the Cardinals did pretty well for what was supposed to be a teardown. I'm not particularly happy about it as a fan of Brewers.
Well, I wouldn't worry that much. But I mean, it is, they did really, like, they basically doubled the amount of relevant prospects in their system. And, I'm not in love with Showalter. Like, I agree with you. I like Showalter probably the most of the pitchers they got. Showalter, Roby, Klofenstein, Rahm, at least two of those guys probably amounts to not much at all. And they probably hit on one and maybe they get just like a big leaguer out of the other one. But they just rarely have had more than two to three interesting arms in that system. And now they have, you know, a half dozen or so. And Sajacy's probably my favorite guy that they got. He's a total Cardinal. Not the same game necessarily, but you know, he just reminds me of a lot of middle infielders for the Cardinals from present and past. And you're dead on with just how well he's been hitting as the weather's heated up here this summer. I really wanted him to get traded from the Rangers just because they had such a logjam of guys that sort of played his positions ahead of him. And, you know, Cardinals maybe not the perfect landing spot just in terms of getting him playing time as soon as possible, but it's a bit more clear for him to get there. And then, you know, Prieto, definitely a spare piece for the Orioles. I wonder if he, I mean, it's just, you know, he almost has to be kind of Luis Arraez level good as a, from a hit tool standpoint, I worry, just kind of given the power and the athleticism. And I don't think he's known as being a great defender, but I mean, when you get this much talent at a deadline, you know, you don't need everyone to hit. So I thought the Cardinals had a good weekend, and I thought it was, you know, I think a lot of the teams that did really well were teams that sort of picked a lane in terms of going for it or selling. And I think some other teams just kind of couldn't really pick a lane and had more underwhelming deadlines. What did you think of the Paul Sewald trade with the Diamondbacks? I got to admit, I'm not very high on any of the guys that the Mariners got back there. And I love that the Diamondbacks got a legitimate ninth inning arm in Sewald, but I don't know. Do you feel differently about Dominic Canzone or Ryan Bliss or Josh Rojas?
So this is one I struggled with. I do like that the Diamondbacks were, you know, able to get a ninth inning arm. They have him for the remainder of this year and next year. Initially, when I saw this news break, I thought it was a pure rental, and I was very confused about the return the Mariners got for a couple months of Paul Sewald's services. I'm not crazy about any of these guys. I think Rojas can play some second base for them as needed. Ryan Bliss, there's a little bit of intrigue. He's very undersized, so, you know, I worry about what the actual impact is there for fantasy purposes. Canzone, I'm not really in love with either. I know there are some people who are higher on him. Eric Cross and Chris Welsh, I think, talked about it earlier this week on a pod. So that was one I know smarted for Welsh, but, you know, this trade in particular didn't do a lot for me on either side. Probably prefer getting the, you know, kind of set it and forget it closer for the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, I mean, I generally side with the buyer, just given the way the market is right now. I think it is a buyer's market in general, and I think Arizona probably sold high on, or relatively high, I guess, on Bliss and Canzone. I definitely get Quad A vibes from Canzone. I know the very small sample, like X stats are favorable for him. But I think Arizona probably did well to get something of value for him. And I mean, where was he really going to play for Arizona anyways? But then also Bliss. I mean, it's that run at Double A Amarillo as a 23-year-old or whatever is really doing all the heavy lifting in terms of propping up his profile.
Yeah, another thing I wonder about Canzone, I don't really know where he plays for Seattle with regularity either. I don't know that he's all that different from Sam Haggerty or Dylan Moore, kind of a fourth outfielder type there too. So I'm not totally sure what the direction is in the outfield, especially since they decided to hold on to Teoscar through the deadline.
Yeah, I mean, I think they probably would have had to just give Teoscar away. And then I'm sure Seattle is high on at least one of those guys and maybe all three of them, but probably Canzone is the headliner there, I guess. So I don't want to just like, I don't think I know these prospects better than Jerry DePoto necessarily, but I do kind of wonder they might've really liked one of these guys. Cause I would think a lot of the, what team couldn't have used a year and a half of Paul Sewald? So I guess kind of interesting that was his market. But what about this last trade for us to recap here? We can go pretty short and sweet on this one, but Michael Lorenzen for How You Lee, Tigers and Phillies making a 1-for-1 there. I thought it was a good win now move for the Phillies, but How You Lee's got a pretty solid hit tool. What do you think about that one?
Yeah, I felt the same way. I'm going to side with the buyer there. If you can get a guy who's going to help you right now in your big league rotation for, I don't want to use the Bob Nightingale fringe prospect terminology.
Oh my God.
That's how
he dropped fringe prospect on Ryan Clifford. That was wild. Yeah. So much shame.
Had a lot of fun on Twitter with that one. But that, that is genuinely kind of how I feel about How You Lee. He came over, I think, in 2021, had a real breakout last year in the Florida State League. I think he won, best hitter in that league last year. I don't know how much fantasy intrigue there really is. It's power over hit, which is a little bit, surprising given his frame. I don't love either side of this deal. If I had to pick a side, I would pick Lorenzen just because it's pitching right now for your big league team.
Yeah, this is another one where I just assume the Tigers like Lee, but I, why didn't a team, could the Reds have beaten this package and gotten Lorenzen? That's maybe my question with this one is more just kind of like there are plenty of teams that needed a guy like Michael Lorenzen, and most of those teams had a prospect of How You Lee's caliber. So just seemed like a good capitalizing on the market there for the Phillies. Let's close it out here with some talk about the midseason prospect mock draft that you and I are both in. You've made your final pick. We did 20 rounds. I think Aaron Judge has been auto picked by probably half the league at this point, or half the mock draft field at this point. But let's start at the very top, because I when you're doing a mock draft, a mock prospect draft, I tend to think the value is usually kind of on these proximity type of guys, because you took Colton Cowser with the 12th overall pick, and then you took Curtis Mead at 16th overall, and you're not going to have like a bunch of people like, oh man, I love that Cowser pick at 12th overall in like a prospect mock draft or anything like that. But I love going Cowser and Mead there. I think they're very safe. They're both big league ready. But I've also kind of noticed I've been getting questions about people sort of panicking about Cowser's slow start. And I don't understand why, but I guess, can you kind of give some thoughts about Cowser and sort of what you like about him and sort of how you project him going forward? Because I think he's great.
I'm a huge Colton Cowser fan. I think right now is the best time to buy that you might have in several years.
Oh yeah.
It's kind of, it goes hand in hand. The best time to buy a prospect is after they've struggled for a month or two. You're seeing a lot of really great examples of this. If you could have bought Riley Green last year, you'd be laughing at the bank right now. Cowser perfectly fits that mold for me. He was one of my favorite targets in the 2021 draft. Everything I saw and read about him at Sam Houston had me weigh in on his hit tool. It's something that I index heavier towards, especially for points leagues that have a K penalty. I don't think the ceiling is necessarily crazy, but I do think that he's going to be a really steady bat hitting, you know, potentially at the top or the middle of a really good Orioles lineup for the next decade or so. You know, a 25-15 kind of guy feels very attainable to me with solid batting averages. I'm just, it's not the sexiest pick in, you know, the 12 spot that I could have made. My tiers kind of really opened up after like the sixth or seventh pick. So I could go the route I wanted to, and I just chose, you know, proximity of a guy I think is going to be rock solid for a long time. And I would be buying if the Couser owner in my league was feeling a little discouraged after 50 or 75 plate appearances.
Yeah, I agree with literally everything you said there. I mean, just go back to sort of where, you know, people, you know, Gunnar Henderson, like 3 weeks into the season, like people were panicking, and I was even lamenting like the one or two spots I got him in redraft. And I mean, you just got to be patient. Well, with when it's a prospect you believed in and you had done the due diligence to kind of figure out what that prospect was all about, like 2 to 3 weeks in the big leagues, even 5 to 6 weeks in the big leagues, shouldn't change your evaluation. And if it's changing other people's evaluation, it's a great time to get in there. You also, you know, I mentioned you went Curtis Meade in the second. You got Max Clark in the third, Jacob Mizrowski in the fourth, Harry Ford in the fifth. I wanted to ask you, though, about Chase Hampton, who you got in the sixth round. I thought that was a very good pick there. I mean, he's, to me, kind of becoming one of the better pitching prospects in the game just due to other players graduating. But talk to me about Chase Hampton and kind of what you see there and where he ranks for you among all pitching prospects.
Yeah, I just popped over to my ranking sheet to see exactly where he fell, and he's at 51. So he just missed my 9 arms in the top 50. I have him as my number 51 overall prospect, my number 10 arm. He is so fun to watch. He has the fastball is lethal, and then he's got two pretty good weapons, you know, to back it up with the slider and the curveball. Right now, I just did a couple queries. He's number 2 in the minors in K minus walk rate among arms over 50 innings. So really just trying to weed out relievers. He's number 5 in the minors in called strike and whiff rate for pitchers who have faced over 100 batters. So that is, again, just trying to weed out relievers. His fastball is wicked. It's really fun to watch. It's one of those that kind of floats and seemingly defies gravity. It's got 19 inches of induced vertical break. A really good fastball is something I look for in pitching prospects now. It's really hard to be successful at the big league level with a fastball that's not so good. And you see that even in Stuff Plus models where they model secondaries off of the fastball because it helps everything play up so much. So Hampton is a ton of fun to watch. I think he has a lot of successful starter traits. I'm hesitant to put like number one overall, number one starter upside on anybody. I think, you know, if I could think of a few just from this year, it would have been Yuri Perez, Paul Skeens, and Gavin Williams. Hampton, I think like ceiling for him looks like a number 2 starter. But he's kind of the, you know, we had that discussion about the arms in the 10 to 30 range or the 15 to 30 range. He's kind of the one I'm planting my flag on. Everything just looks outstanding.
Yeah. Love all that. Yeah. And you got him in the 6th, and this is a, you know, I mean, I just want to look at how many pitchers went ahead of him here. So in reverse order, Brian Wu, Cade Horton, AJ Smith, Shaver, Brandon Pfaadt, Tink Hentz, Emmett Sheehan, Kyle Harrison, Andrew Painter, Jacob Mizrowski, Shane Baz, Gavin Williams, Ricky Tiedemann, Paul Skeens, Mason Miller. Jesse Roach in these things, like, far be it for me to tell anyone what settings they should set these mocks up for, but I just hate it when these pitchers who I've graduated because of 45 days on the active roster and have fewer than 50 innings, like, Jesse just kept, he took Shane Baz, Brian Wu, and Reese Olson, who I would have, every single one of those guys I would have taken ahead of him if I had remembered they were eligible for this thing due to innings. But yeah, I mean, you got Hampton well outside the first 10 pitching prospects off the board. So nice job there. What did you think about the rest of this mock exercise? Was there anyone you really wanted that you got sniped on? Any kind of just general observations of sort of the lay of the land right now in terms of the prospect universe?
Yeah, I think as I was going through this, we're at a really interesting point in the season where the trade deadline is passed. We have new draftees. We have almost enough, you know, track record this year to feel good about some players and where they're going to rank. And I don't think everybody's crystallized on how their tiers really shake out outside of, you know, the top 25 or so. So there's a lot of different opinions out there. I always enjoy, you know, taking part in these just to see, you know, kind of pressure test where I have people ranked. I will say at the spot I took Mead, I was also considering Kobe Mayo and Gavin Williams at that point. I don't know if that's the points league in me with Williams, you know, jumping up to grab a pitcher at 17, but I've held pretty steady on Mead throughout the course of the year. I know there were some people that dropped him a little bit as he worked through injury, but Mayo has been unbelievable this year. He was really interesting to follow almost immediately after he was drafted over slot. I was pretty overjoyed to get Jacob Mizorowski in the fourth. I don't know if I'm drunk on his stuff or if I'm underestimating the reliever risk there, but I'm a huge Mizorowski fan. I actually have him as my number four overall pitching prospect. And then, you know, as I was going back over the draft board, that run of Horton, Wu, Locklear, Isaac, Carson Williams in the fifth leading up to my Hampton pick felt like all of my cue was going to be gone by the time it got to me. So I was happy to get Hampton there. I would have loved any of them at that spot or even being available, you know, on the wheel there, assuming they made it past Jeff Ponce and Chris Welsh.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Matt Eddy just kept peppering my queue when I would let someone get to him at the, he was picking first, I was picking third. So I should have done a better job of keeping away Mets really more than anything else. Jet Williams, that one stung, but yeah, it was a lot of fun participating in that with you. Zach, anything you want to plug, anything you want to tell the listeners about, anything you've been working on?
Yeah, I mean, I do Dynasty and Prospect Ranks for Points Leagues. All of my stuff goes up on the Dynasty Dugout. That's Chris Clegg's Substack. I can't recommend it enough. We've got a really active Discord with guys who are talking baseball literally 24/7. And I mean that, like, I wake up to a lot of messages every morning. Somebody found a diamond in the rough somewhere, and we've all got to, you know, have a group film session. ton of fun. All my stuff goes up on Twitter as well. I'm at @upper_Beck. That's where all of my baseball takes, good and bad, live. But yeah, that's pretty much it for me.
Well, thanks again for hanging out with me on this Wednesday evening, Zach. It was a lot of fun chatting with you. I'm sure we'll get to catch up plenty more in the future. So thanks again. This has been the RotoWire Prospect Podcast. Thanks to everyone for listening. I'll be back with another episode in a week.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one?
Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.